Hark, it's the 87th Precinct podcast. It's 2018, and it's our first podcast of the new year. We've buffed Kenneth's faux walnut veneer. We've buffed Kenneth's faux walnut veneer. You know, giving him a new lick of paint, and he's ready to do some calculating about what the scores are for the next few Ed McBain 87th Precinct novels. And the one we're looking at today is The Heckler, Ed McBain's second book from 1960. And an amazing story, really, and it's got all sorts in, not least the introduction of a very, very important character for the future of the series. Before we get going on that, though, I would like to mention that we have obviously got our Twitter feed and our Facebook page, and we have our website and blog. Today was one of those rare occasions where things go really well with social media, because I was flicking through, checking references to people who'd said something about Ed McBain and 87th Precinct, as I do, and I found someone who said, and I quote, "Anyone got a list of the 87th Precinct books in the right order?" That's what our website's for. Yeah. It's on there. The website's been updated recently as well, so I've been including, as we go through each book, extra information that you can click through on there. That's hark87thprecinct.blogspot.com. And that should be a good resource for that. So that was good. It was nice to be able to point someone in the right direction there. And that was someone from Sweden who's trying to collect all the books. So that's, I mean, it's a bit of a challenge in the UK to collect them. I wonder what it's like trying to collect them in a Scandinavian country, really. I don't know whether it's any more or less difficult.
I'm really not sure.
I suppose if you're collecting English editions, that's probably the easiest thing. But perhaps if you, I don't know how widely they've been translated. I should imagine quite widely now.
Yeah, I know Sir Wal and Walu, who I've definitely mispronounced, of the Martin Beck series, were big fans. So I don't know if they read them in translation or if they read them in the originals.
I don't know. But, you know, the hunt for the secondhand books, as we've said before, is always part of the joy of the thing.
Absolutely.
So, anyway, there we go. Check out the website if you want any information on the 87th Precinct series. I try and keep as much stuff on there as possible, get it updated as we go along. But now, we return to the matter in hand, which is The Heckler, and I am joined, as always, by Stephen Royston.
Hello.
And Morgan Brown, who you've already heard, these two.
Why, hello there.
Happy New Year, gentlemen.
Happy New Year,
it's still January.
It is, just we can still say it.
When you're officially not allowed to say Happy New Year, is it just after the first time you meet someone for the first time in the new year?
No, because I imagine you didn't see somebody till December. You wouldn't be able to say Happy New Year then, would you?
No, that's true. You
know, first couple of weeks in January, after that.
After that, it's weird, so I shouldn't have said it.
Yeah, I know, you've made everyone uncomfortable now, including yourself and the listeners.
Oh, God, I'm on the back foot right from the start.
It'd be all right if they're listening to this early next year.
That'll be fine.
Okay. That's, you know, I'll put
Happy
that
New Year for that.
I'll put
listeners.
It on the Twitter feed. And don't listen to this until January 2019, and then only between the 1st and the 14th of the month.
Yeah, correct. Hence that would seem appropriate then.
Goodness knows what book we'll be on by that point. I can't do the brain sums.
No, all right.
So, let's get on to The Heckler, because I haven't got anything else. I'll tell you what I have got to mention. And this is, again, something I came across on social media because of some of the things I follow through our Twitter feed. And I did share this. On the 17th of January this month, there was an article I saw. It was a photo article from a newspaper about a detective who's retired. She's 95 years old. She just had a birthday on the 17th, called Detective Mary Fitzgerald. And she retired from the cops in New York in 1983. She joined the force in 1952 and was one of the first women detectives. Right. Mm-hmm. And so her story is quite important. She was promoted to detective in 1959 and became detective second grade in 1968. So she was one of the first women to do so. So when Ed McBain was writing these books, which at this point are still very light on female cop characters, he would have been around getting to know cops, getting to know people in the force to get his background information, which I think he did lots more of early on and then sort of didn't do as much later. She'd have been around then and maybe she would have been the inspiration for someone like Eileen Burke, Eileen Burke, who was a detective in one story we've seen so far.
Yeah, because she disappears for quite a long time, actually.
She's not truly a cop of the 87th Precinct.
No, she's not.
She's always on loan, isn't she?
That's right.
But Mary Fitzgerald herself was in all sorts of different squads. The pickpocket squad, the intelligence division.
The pickpocket squad.
I know, it just that sounds a bit Dickensian, doesn't it? The pickpocket squad.
When you started this story, I was very confused because I thought you were suggesting that this 95-year-old detective had just handed in her shield and like...
Just now.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit
I don't know
like,
what squad she'd be on at 94 years old.
Yeah, well... Anyway, I thought that was a nice story, and it just sort of tallies in with the world we're talking about still.
It does,
as well.
Really, yeah.
And the subject of women in McBain books is something that I suspect is going to come up in this discussion. Well, I know it is because I'm going to mention it. So let's get into the heckler, really.
Let's get heckling.
See, that's a funny thing. Was this term heckling, the heckler?
I know, it's
just
a bit...
feels a bit weird, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit of an odd name because heckling's only a byproduct of what's at. A foot, isn't it?
Yeah, because we think of heckling as being someone at a comedy, stand-up comedy show.
Yeah.
Going, ah, oh, you shit.
But this guy's going, yeah, you're going to die unless you get out of that loft. Stupid loft.
Stupid loft. He hates loft-based material.
Stupid loft. That'd be more of a heckle, wouldn't it? Oh, yeah. You Raskin, your loft's stupid.
Yeah. Your dresses are shit.
But what would the alternatives be? The threatener?
Yeah, I know. It's a,
sounds like a Edward Woodward episode of The Equalizer or something.
The Equalizer.
The threatener. The threatener.
Edward Woodward.
Or what's a Jason Statham movie from like the late noughties?
Before he gets given the role of Parker.
So, yeah. Oh, God. The heckler, yeah, always a funny.
So perhaps it was part of the vernacular at the time, the language. So because otherwise it would have make no sense for him to use it as the title and it descriptively as the notion of someone who rings up people and threatens them down the phone, and you don't know whether they're a crank or they're serious.
I don't want to be jumping ahead to the books though, but as books go, the cover of mine looks absolutely ridiculous in that the. The title is The Heckler, and then there's just some feet on some leaves without trousers on.
Hold
and
it
if
there.
If you were to get this book, you'd be like, what on earth?
Who killed that scout?
Somebody heckled him to death. Yeah. I know.
Well, we'll go into that in more detail in the bonus. The bonus.
I think it makes the title even more ridiculous than it,
that
you know, than it
edition,
would be
yeah.
Elsewhere. Because at least yours there is like a telephone, and that is the medium of the heckling in this. It wasn't
indeed.
In-person heckling.
No.
Various businesses.
He wasn't just literally stood outside these buildings just shouting at them.
Get out your loft.
Get out your shit loft.
But yeah, it was various telephone calls, heckling, various different businesses dotted around the 87th precinct.
All of which are situated near to or above something that contains wealth or value, such as a bank or a jade merchant or something like that. A jewellery store as well is one of them.
As we, the reader, sort of realised before the cops of the 87th actually kind of cotton on to it, really.
Well, because the Red-Headed League gets a mention very early in this.
Well, before we go too far into Sherlock...
Which is to kind of give the game away somewhat, intentionally.
We've got a lot of Sherlock Holmes stuff to cover in this, really, in a way, because there's very specific mention of the Red-Headed League, as you say.
There is, yeah.
But we should just say it up front. This is the novel that introduces the character The Deaf Man, and he returns several times to plague the 87th Precinct. He's their supervillain, really. Yep. I mean, he's not in every one by any means. In fact, he's only a handful of books. But he's, because of the nature of this character, he's very significant in the series. And it gives Ed McBain license to really do twisty-turny plots and have fun with the character as well.
Well, it also, the thing reading this back, I would say more than any other, is you must spend at least half the book with the villain, don't you? And then plotting the crime.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is a total departure, I think, from all the others where you're left in the dark, aren't you, by the...
You get given his procedure as much as you get given the
cop's
procedure.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Which is
probably more.
Yeah, which is...
You mainly get the cops kind of scratching their heads and then lots of the deaf man creating these... ever more elaborate kind of webs of intrigue.
But our first sort of Sherlock reference is that the obvious comparison, and whenever you do any research or look into anything about the Deaf Man, is he is the 87th Precinct's Moriarty figure, which sort of casts Steve Carella almost as Holmes, which is not really that, but he is more like a Moriarty. Now, I mean, Steve-O, you're a well-read about Sherlock mysteries, and although I know we've all read them, you've certainly studied them a bit more than us. So what's Moriarty's role in Sherlock Holmes? I mean,
he's quite funny in the, because he's in and out. He's kind of built up to be this total nemesis in a very short period of time in the books. It's a bit strange, really.
His legacy's perhaps outlived as the man.
It's not as though he's in every single book or even a majority of the books. He's just kind of mentioned, and then all of a sudden he's, you know, throwing Holmes off a waterfall. So yeah, it's a bit odd that way. Whereas this, the relationship with the deaf man's a bit kind of, you know, he keeps coming back and causing havoc at different periods of time. But yeah, in the Sherlock Holmes novels, short stories, Moriarty was a kind of a mastermind coordinator rather than somebody going out pulling off the capers himself.
Pulling off capers.
Pulling off capers, yeah. But also the fact that all the Sherlock Holmes canon is all over the place in terms of chronology. It allows some of the later books to then kind of shoehorn Moriarty in as though he was somehow responsible. But where you meet him and he's actually in order, the order of the books was written.
He's obviously very important to people who've adapted Holmes. Something really easy to latch onto, and they keep using Moriarty to varying degrees of success, it must be said.
But I think there's 56 short stories, I think, or 50, something like that. And I bet he's not in more than 3 or 4.
Yeah.
I was going to say low number.
I was going to say, I've read quite a lot, and I don't think I've ever read a single one with Moriarty. And the only thing I've read with Moriarty in was that Anthony Horowitz one. Yeah. Which just felt like he tried to cram in every single thing that had ever been in any Sherlock Holmes story into a single thing. It was like a sort of greatest hits medley of bits from Sherlock Holmes.
In fact, thinking about it, in terms of him being a character where he has dialogue, it might even only be one.
So just the Reichenbach Falls story?
Yeah, the final problem. Mm. Yeah, that would be interesting to note anyway. So yeah, more of a casts a longer shadow.
Yeah. But so the nature of Moriarty is every supervillain gets compared to him. So-and-so is the Moriarty of so-and-so else. And that's what they say about the Deaf Man. Interesting thing in this, and I'd be interesting to look forward to the other books that he's in, is he's never referred to with capital letters. He is in this story, because it's the way the police see him, they only know the Deaf Man. And the other people who he's working with only know that he's the Deaf Man, even though he does use a fake name for certain purposes, and it's a trick name.
Yeah.
And it's all lowercase Deaf Man, but I think as people refer to him later in terms of his character, he becomes uppercase Deaf Man. Like, almost like a superhero. And he's a brilliant character. One of the really good things about him is that he's really, really, well, he's another Moriarty thing. Moriarty's background is academic, isn't it? He's maths and stuff like that, isn't he?
Yeah, they're both smart asses, aren't they? utterly confident of their impending supreme victory.
He certainly very much enjoys lauding his intelligence and mastery of all these different things over all of his underlings, doesn't
he? Exactly. So they share that trait, definitely.
It comes out
in
the form of a really detailed description of the odds of a poker game, which I'm rubbish with maths at the best of time. And you read it and you're thinking, blimey, is this right or not? I'm sure it is. I'm sure if you're working out. And also the odds on how his plan's going to come to fruition in terms of how many police are available to do what job and what places as well.
I'm fairly sure if you were playing poker against him and he was talking like that, you would just punch him in the face.
It's a kind of a miracle that no one does during that scene.
It's so annoying.
And that's very, very early on in the book.
That kind of sets out his character quite well, that scene, doesn't it? When he's playing poker with his
I think it's in chapter three straight away.
With his fellow heisters.
Heist squad. Three of the men in the poker game were getting slightly PO'd.
Bet they were.
Given that the violence and graphicness of some of this book to not say pissed off. It's quite an interesting one. But that might be quite a clever thing by the writer in terms of him keeping it quite, it seems a bit like the other ones, and then it gets the ramps up some of the graphicness, and how it ends is amazing.
Mm.
That's our big first sort of Sherlock Holmes link into this, and we'll come to at some point the other main one, which is to do with the Red-Headed League, as Steve-O mentioned before. Mm. One of the things I like very, very much about McBain books, and we've talked about it a bit, is the reproduction forms and procedures, and like where you see these different messages and it's all done as graphics. Chapter 8 in my book is where this becomes like, this is like the pinnacle of McBain reproductions. There's one chapter in this book which is simply, other than one large paragraph reporting a conversation over a police radio, is entirely made up of reproduction forms and documents.
Yeah. Mm.
That's McBain doing that to the absolute nth degree. He's just given up on trying to actually write any descriptive stuff, and he has gone completely through procedure by reproducing forms. Central complaint desk report, case report, what else have we got? Evidence tag, teletype, telex machine message, something like that.
Is there as many as those in the later books? I'm trying to remember now. Were they a bit of a thing of this?
I feel like it kind of tails off a bit later on.
Possibly as communication changes in the future, where it's more direct communication, there's more means of actually just speaking information.
Probably, yeah.
Via the radios, via mobile communication, via computers. I don't know. Is there any computer screen reproductions and things like that? We're a long way off finding out. But
yeah. I kind of feel like he's just sort of phased that out a little bit by the time you get away through the 80s, certainly.
The books are a lot bigger, so he's got more story and character to pack into.
I guess normally novels where the Deaf Man features, you tend to still get a bit of that because there'll normally be some kind of incredibly obtuse clues that have to be reproduced. But
8 Black Horses.
That's got some tremendous things.
I like in chapter 7 in this, though,
the ferry
timetable. You know, he must have sat there, or if he had an assistant to help, you know, I don't know. Because I think he had, like, somebody who helped him with his research, so he might have just nicked an actual one and just changed the thing on the top for all I
possibly,
know.
Possibly, yeah.
Well, it's a great attention to detail.
I'd been looking at a timetable for a train, an American train, because I'm thinking of going on holiday and perhaps doing one of the big train journeys. And I was looking at this timetable, and it is one of the most complex documents I have ever seen, this Amtrak train timetable, because it's got a train that joins a train in the middle of it, and you have to sort of work it around. There's arrows with brackets, there's all these icons. You go from a direction in one way, then you have to read the timetable the other way around if you're going back. Oh, I was confused. Needless to say that this train, if I do get it, to look at the lovely lakes between New York and Chicago... Well, we'll pass them while I'm fast asleep at 4:20 in the morning, so hey-ho.
Although you'd be going near that mountain range that we talked about.
The Adirondacks. Adirondacks.
Is that how it goes? I forgot already.
No, the Dodi-Didondacks.
But you also go past the Finger Lakes, which is a reference in a Saturday Night Live series of sketches, which is my favourite sketch. The Finger Lakes. The Maharel sisters, all the way from the Finger Lakes. So, people might get that reference. They might not. I enjoyed saying it, though. That's the important thing.
It is indeed.
So the book ramps up quite quickly with not only these threatening phone calls coming through to someone that Maya knows from a family perspective. Maya's sort of involved at the start because he knows this guy. The guy comes to see him.
Mm.
But within a chapter, we've also got a corpse. And this corpse is found in the park on April Fool's Day. So we can. This is quite well dated, this book, because the threats are made, get out by April the 30th. They've started by April the 1st. And then there's lots of dates mentioned in there, which nerds like me like.
I suppose the book lasts exactly a month then, doesn't it?
A little bit more. I think it goes into 2 weeks into May, I think, from my recollection. Well, let's see what I've got on my little list here. Andy Parker. Let's talk about Andy Parker. Detective Andy Parker. Doesn't have much to do in this book.
No, he's kind of in it initially quite a bit, and then he just disappears off to a flipping candy store and you don't hear from him again.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He does sideline a few detectives in this. Given that by the end of the book they've brought back everyone, the entire police department's been recalled from leave and they're all working together because of the scale of what happens at the end of it. Andy Parker, he just leaves him in here so he can make fun of the fact that even when he's dressed as himself, he looks like he's on a stakeout as a slob.
He might be better to talk about in detail in the next one, because isn't he heavily involved in the...
I think the next story...
I believe so, yeah.
And the next story also features Detective Frankie Hernandez, who...
Cropped up last time, did he?
Yeah, he's been in a
couple... For the very first time.
Has he been in a couple?
I think he's been in a couple by this point.
He progressively becomes...
He was the unwitting trigger in a little bit of fisticuffs between Steve and Andy Parker earlier. And yeah.
Well, this is the most he's been in to date.
He does get a good chapter, an interview chapter in this with Steve Carella. But he's also just given a job by Captain Frick. There's a scene where Captain Frick, in my mind, just wanders into the squad room completely lost, doesn't know what's going on, and just like, where's Frankie Hernandez? Where is he? And he's just given a sort of job with the Puerto Rican community, which is basically his lot in life in that job. You sort of sideline Andy Parker, but you see him. You sideline Frankie Hernandez, save for the little bit of work he does with Steve Carella in the chapter after. You don't see Cotton Hawes in this at all.
No,
Cotton Hawes and Brown must be the two who were up in Washington on the
training
FBI
course
or whatever.
What do you reckon they were doing on the FBI training course in 1960?
Don't know. Bomb calls, maybe?
Well, they would have been very useful down here.
Yeah. That's why I don't know.
Neither do I, because we're not in the FBI. And they're not listening. They're not listening to this.
Not at all.
Bet they're not. They're not. That's the sad thing. We need the numbers. But yeah, there's a lot. The city, as usual, is a character in this. And one of the things about this is that lots of the stories based around the idea that the city is changing quite significantly. Mm. It's being redeveloped. And I believe that is actually what was happening in New York at the time. So this is, again, it's a parallel New York. So lots of places were getting bulldozed, rebuilt, lots of urban renewal and development, which happened in lots of places in 1960. It happened in the UK a lot because places like Liverpool got bombed to shit in the war. And also there was sort of new thinking, new ideas, new technologies. But obviously it was happening in cities like New York to quite an extent. And that sets the scene for everything that's happening. It's the chaos and confusion that's already there, the baseline of when some development work goes on and roads are closed and there's buildings and there's all this, that and the other happening as well. So that's quite interesting. And according to this story, that there's a statue of Daniel Webster in Grover Park. It's mentioned very early on in this. Do you know who Daniel Webster is? Not Kevin Webster.
From Coronation
Not
Street.
Not Kevin Webster from Coronation Street, no.
I have no idea.
He says there's a statue of Daniel Webster, and I thought, well, that must be someone. I wonder if our American listeners all know who he is. Apparently he is, or rather he was, a senator and served under a couple of presidents as US Secretary of State. So we're talking like the late... he was born in 1782, so we're talking 1840s, basically. He's quite a big and important figure. But Central Park has a massive statue of him in. Grover Park and Central Park, again, they're absolute parallels. They've got the statue of Daniel Webster in there.
Would that make him Secretary of State under James K. Polk?
Well, no, it wouldn't, but that's a very good guess. You can have two more guesses at the two presidents that he was Secretary of State under.
Martin Van Buren?
No.
I'm stumped.
You can have my guesses.
Yeah. John Tyler and Millard Fillmore.
I wouldn't have got either of those.
No. It's just not part of our history lessons growing up.
Would Polk and Van Buren be earlier or later then?
Van Buren, I think, was earlier. James K. Polk, 1844, I think.
Yeah.
Just thinking...
Well, I've no doubt that...
They might be Giant Song. They wouldn't have lied to me.
They would have known him, though. They would have known him.
Yeah, Daniel Webster would have been around for a lot of that. So, what happens in this book, then? What happens in this book? We have the corpse. We've got these threatening phone calls. We've got, basically, a bank heist being planned by the Deaf Man.
We have, yeah.
And the Deaf Man has a sequence in this book where he decides to pick up a girl... And it's quite difficult to read, really. I found it especially because I'd started considering some of this writing in a different way. And the sequence where he meets this girl in a bar and he sort of planned it a bit like one of his crime schemes, which we assume he must have done some of these before. He sort of plans it and meets her, and he sort of targets her. He just gets this girl drunk. And the way it's described in the book, it's almost like he's drugged her to the point of, like, he can do what he wants with her. It's horrible,
it's
really.
It's horrible. It's very, very uncomfortable reading, yeah.
So you have this very clinical and precise crime figure who applies this to human beings as well, and he does not care about human beings one bit, whether it's taking someone to have sex with or people who stand in the way of him and the money that he wants. And it's, bit scary, that one. And the way they dealt with it in the TV version that we've just watched is, funnily enough, in the 1961 TV series, The 87th Precinct, they don't have a sort of drunken, drugged up sex party scene. What they do is they retain the character of Lottie Constantine, and he just takes her hostage, basically, and just binds her to him by bullets and throwing knives across
the room. Apple knives.
The deaf man peels an apple in that episode and doesn't eat any of it, just seems to keep chopping bits off and then throws his knife across the room.
He does,
I hope he disinfects it afterwards. Otherwise, if he keeps eating fruit, he'll get all sorts. So, the deaf man on TV, played by?
Robert Vaughan.
Yeah, Robert Vaughan.
Man from Uncle.
Only two people have ever played the deaf man in any media other than the books, where he's played by himself. Yes. Robert Vaughan in the TV series and in the film Fuzz. I suspect will be an exciting highlight when we get around to it. He's played by Yul Brynner.
Amazing. All right.
Okay. So those are the two people who've played the deaf man on TV. And
they're both actually deaf in real life.
Are they?
No.
Well, I was hoping that I could find out a load of interesting information about them or whether there's any trivia, but I don't really know much about either of them other than, say, you know, Robert Vaughan's career, although it was in film to some extent, was mainly a TV career.
Mm. Robert Vaughan was very political, a big supporter of the Democrat Party. Mm. Anti-Vietnam War kind of guy. Chums with the Kennedys, I think.
According to some of the trivia submitted by our pals, Robert Vaughan played three different US presidents on screen. Mm. I don't know who they are anymore.
Polk Van Buren.
John Tyler, Millard Fillmore. And our friend Andy Davies, Dr. Andy Davies, who's contributed before, said, "For some reason, every time I think of Robert Vaughan, I think of Battle Beyond the Stars, a film title which makes no sense as the fighting takes place in, not beyond space. But in that film, he plays exactly the same character as he does in the Magnificat. Meh? In the Magnificat? I've just invented a new Disney film.
Excellent.
Not the Aristocats. The Magnificats.
Yeah.
I think that's Latin, isn't it, Magnificat?
I believe so.
As he does in The Magnificent Seven, which obviously also starred Yul Brynner. So yes, they obviously worked together. So two deaf men in one ensemble.
Amazing.
As it were. And on the subject of Yul Brynner, our friend Robin said, Yul Brynner starred in an anti-smoking film, From Beyond the Grave. His first words in this were, "I'm Yul Brynner and I'm dead." Mm. I vaguely remember that, vaguely.
But he was a robot, wasn't he?
All along,
absolutely. All the while. Evil cowboy robot.
I don't know who you'd cast as the deaf man now. Say you were going to make this book now. The trouble you have with thinking about the characters.
Well, I think Robert Vaughan was very well cast, actually, because he's a smooth operator, isn't he? And that's what Robert Vaughan was very good. You can see why he was cast.
Yeah, he was a good pick for that TV episode.
Somebody suave, you know, good-looking guy.
Suave with, sort of a certain personal magnetism, but also this kind of, like,
nastiness.
Intensity?
An intensity, and then, that sort of that edge of vanity about his own brilliance, which always ends up being his undoing, really, as well.
Yeah, difficult to say. But of somebody of that ilk, anyway.
Yeah, you do need that intensity. The deaf man uses the name El Sordo in this, and that's actually how the character's credited in the TV episode as well. And El Sordo is a joke name, which is a trope of what the deaf man likes to do, which is come up with something clever, set stupid riddles, use Shakespeare or Sherlock Holmes or whatever to confuse and confound his enemies. In this one, he's not anticipating actually deliberately winding the police up. He's trying to distract them. Mm. in future books, he gets a bit sort of obsessed with the idea of actually targeting the 87th precinct.
Yeah, it becomes more of a vendetta, really, every time, doesn't it?
Well, he's determined to get one over on them.
And he nearly does in this, because he nearly robs us of one of our main characters again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You'd think for such a good cop, Steve Carella would not get shot so often.
Yeah, it's one of his few failings is inability to avoid being shot repeatedly.
And you don't know whether he's going to survive. I mean, our spoiler policy of not having a spoiler policy, I think you know that Steve Carella's in future books, listener, dear listener.
A bit of a giveaway.
He does get shot, and there is a lot of his comatose thoughts going on in this. So where the deaf man works out his plan out loud and tells us all about his playing the odds, Steve Carella does his in his head whilst in a coma and can't really help anyone. But it's another interesting way of looking at the character.
It sets up the very personal battle they have in future Deaf Man installments, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The shooting, and he gets his head bashed in by the butt of a shotgun as well.
He does indeed, yeah. It doesn't sound good. I'm not surprised from the description of it that he recovers as well as he does.
Mm.
Yeah, because in the TV episode, they just they shoot Bert Kling instead.
Poor Bert.
And just ship him off to the hospital, but he's all right within a couple of weeks.
Absolutely,
we're led
to
believe by the time frame of that story.
I'd like to imagine that the sort of pirouette that he did when being shot might have dampened the impact of the bullet somewhat.
Yeah, it's beautiful. He turns, he spins round to see the deaf man. He's like Nureyev or another ballet dancer who I can't think of anymore. More ballet dancers?
Nijinsky.
Nijinsky, there you go.
There we go.
What about that guy with lots of hair?
The guy with lots of
hair. Oh, God, what's he called?
The ballet dancer with lots of hair.
Yeah, like English guy.
English ballet dancer with lots of hair. This sounds like a crossword clue. We'll let someone else
proceed.
We'll let someone else fill that gap in. If you can think of the English ballet dancer with lots of hair, that's
he looks a bit like. He looks a bit like the singer with loads of hair. The small guy from the 70s. Disco guy.
You're not thinking of Wayne Sleep, are
you? Was he a ballet dancer?
To some extent.
And he had lots of hair.
He wasn't a classical ballet dancer.
Not strictly.
He was ballet trained.
Who was the guy I think he looks like?
Who does Wayne Sleep look like?
Leo Sayer?
Yeah. That's it.
We got to the end of it.
He spun like Leo Sayer.
Never let it be said that we're easily distracted.
No, no way at all.
Mm.
Oh, goodness me.
Wayne Sleep. That's the guy, yeah.
Brilliant. Gosh, we're sort of jumping around in the story a little bit here.
I think we need to talk about the red-headed league reference, which is very early in the book, and it sets up the entire point of all these. All the heckling, the motive for the heckling is back to the poker game, really, isn't it? And it's the deaf man's way of stacking the deck in his favour, and putting the odds against the police in them, sorting out finding his crime. Although you kind of help but feel that if he'd not done any of that,
he probably wouldn't have known anyway.
That's the point of him. He's almost like too much of a smart ass.
Yeah, he really enjoys coming up with these wild, clever schemes. Whereas if he just did one thing really well, it'd be fine.
All he needed to do here is set his bomb in the stadium and then rob the bank, and he would have probably got away with it.
It's just a massive show-off, isn't it? It's the same kind of megalomaniacal thinking that always causes Bond villains to create the very slow means of killing him. It's that sort of mindset, I guess.
But anyway, that's his his way of getting the deck stacked. He's got all these diversional crimes, and the reference to the Red-Headed League was a Sherlock Holmes story where the character was joined and employed by the Red-Headed League to copy manually an encyclopedia in some rented offices for the sole purpose of getting him out his own business, where his assistant was digging a tunnel from his basement into a bank.
Which is what happens in this.
So it's kind of a double Double analogy.
The strange thing is this. In this book, one of the cops, Birkling, is reading the Red-Headed League.
Yeah, you think he'd have... I don't know.
Well, they have a bit of sort of like the... Because someone's working on the murder, someone's working on the heckling court.
Yeah, they don't pull it all together, do they?
They've only heard little bits about each other's cases and haven't really conferred on them, and it doesn't quite click that the things are connected, does it? And
I think it's the references to the hard of hearing and what's its name that eventually he realised they're dealing with the same individual behind the heckling.
But taking the Red-Headed League even further, the deaf man can't resist actually sending hordes of redheads round to annoy Dave Raskin, the first victim, at his loft.
Does he send him a load of chairs and then food?
He sends him... So poor Dave Raskin, who's getting these threatening calls to get out or I'll kill you, is getting sent envelopes that he hasn't ordered, like industrial amounts of stationery, all with his address on it saying the vacant loft company or something like that. He gets a load of caterers turning up, loads of chairs and tables, a load of musicians, including a band leader with a Hitler moustache, apparently.
That's right.
And they're all turning up to say, well, you ordered it. And he's going, no. And so
he's quite a funny character, isn't he, old Raskin?
He's fairly entertaining, Raskin.
Although he does a bit of a sex pest.
Pretty much like a dreadful pervert as well.
Well, I think this is the trigger to mentioning what, in discussions with my partner Lorraine, is known in the industry as breasted boobily. The idea that when male writers write women, they tend to do this thing where they overemphasize physical things. Rather than sort of talking about someone looking nice, everything becomes about usually the boobs. And Ed McBain, you can't get away from it, in this book, is really bad for it.
Absolutely. I mean, you get it in quite a few of particularly the earlier novels.
A man of the boob, clearly.
And he sort of has this girl that works for Dave Raskin, and she's very... Well, she's described in some detail, and her boobs are the main thing. It's like... And I'm just looking now... This is from later in the book. This isn't even the worst bit of a description of this character of Margarita. And I'm just going to read it out. Raskin went back to the loft on Culver Avenue, where Margarita was packing their stock preparatory to the move, flinging her unbound breasts about with renewed fervour. How, with even the basic sense of human anatomy, if you've just looked at a woman, regardless of size of endowment, you'd be thinking, if I wanted this person to do a job, say pack this chest full of folded dresses, the least efficient way to do it is to wave your chest around with, as they say, renewed fervour.
Yeah.
It's sort of rubbish, really. And then there's the girl that the deaf man picks up, and she's described similarly. And there's also a bit where the bank manager of the bank that's the target...
I forgot about him, isn't it?
His assistant or someone else who works at the bank comes over, and she's got a top button undone, and he's looking at her boobs, and he's talking about pinching her bottom. Although he has Steve Carella thinking about pinching someone's bottom as well earlier on. And what I did...
It was a bygone age.
Well, it certainly was, which... Yeah. You know, it's the only excuse you can give it, really. It's very difficult to read now. When you notice it, this book, out of all of the ones we've read, it's not even the description of a femme fatale or anything like that, which is sort of intrinsic to the older sort of detective and noir stories. This is just boobs are great, lads, aren't they?
There is a bit of that about it, yeah, which is not what we encourage.
Where does he get to his sexy novels?
Well, yeah. But,
oh, God.
Well, there's a reviewer called Marilyn Stasio who wrote reviews for the New York Times, I think, for a long time. She was a crime fiction reviewer. And I listened to a podcast where she was being interviewed. And there's a good bit about Ed McBain on it. Very short section.
What's she saying?
So I shall read out what it is. This, I must say, I found on the This Is Criminal podcast on the episode called The Gatekeeper. And I'll put the link to that on the Twitter feed. So you can go and listen to the original, as it were, because Marilyn Stasio has a very amusing laugh as well. Very engaging to listen to. So she describes this meeting, reading this Ed McBain book. And she says, it was a woman who was leaning against this patterned wallpaper. And it looked like a jungle. And he was comparing her to some kind of jungle animal, cat. And I remember I met him, and I remember laughing. He was really, really mad. He followed me down wherever we were, and he said, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't laugh. And I said, well, you should write better women. And then he did. He really did write, and I must say, towards the end, he was writing really good female characters.
Mm.
So it took the crime reviewer, Marilyn Stasio, actually going up to him and just laughing in his face to upset him to the point where he actually thought, well, perhaps I could write a bit more.
Well, we must certainly thank her for doing that.
Yeah, so it's a very amusing story.
That's
so
great.
All hail Marilyn.
Mm.
Yeah, so let's discuss the end of this book, because the TV episode is very low-key. Mm. It sort of plays on the main bits of the crime, the start, the middle, the end, but it doesn't do what the book does, which is full-scale terrorism when you think about
Absolutely,
so it's not just one-man crime wave.
Do you have like a dozen bombs? Is it something like that, isn't it, around the city?
Yeah. He actually puts a bomb in... Well, the police are already engaged in crowd control for a huge ball game, and he puts a bomb there that goes off as people are...
He puts two panic. Inside, so therefore people are leaving, and then he leaves one in one of the main exits, and then that goes off, and it doesn't go into any detail at all about like the
fallout from.
But you're led to believe that it would be dozens, if not hundreds, of
there would certainly be a lot of fatalities. I mean, they're calling in the National Guard and everything, aren't they? It's a very serious kind of terrorist situation. So.
And yet he's totally. He doesn't go. I just found it strange. He doesn't go into any detail.
Well,
on that.
I think the funny thing is with this, reading it now from our perspective, in a time when there's been a lot more terrorist incidents that this is similar to, even if you include like the one-off bombs, like the Manchester bomb last year, which took lots of lives. This is lots of bombs in a very populous place, planted very deliberately. In fact, one of the things that Ed McBain does in this book is describe in quite some detail how to make these bombs. You know, I assume he's missed steps out in there. It can't be as simple as he says. But it's a campaign to actually not just distract the police, but actually cause things that are very, very damaging to human life. Yeah. The ball game one's terrifying because stadiums then wouldn't have seen anything like this. They wouldn't have been prepared for mass evacuation. Mm. And we know the side effects of what goes wrong when stadiums go wrong. And so that could have been a story. Nowadays, that would be the story itself, wouldn't it? The terrorism aspect.
And that's just the distraction in this. But, it's a mixture of different kinds of devices. Well, the explosive devices and incendiary ones as well, aren't there?
Mm.
To cause different kinds of mayhem in different areas, just to make things even more difficult for everyone. So,
in the TV episode, they were just smoke bombs, weren't they?
Like minor mischief to slightly.
But yeah, there's one in a theatre, a cinema in this, wasn't there? Cinema?
Yeah, I think it even says that one of the ones in the cinema or the theatre is placed near the poles to try and cause structural damage and stuff like that, which could collapse whole buildings and things like that. So he is a baddie, the deaf man. He's not just in it for the money as easily as possible, get in and get out. He wants to, you know, really ensure he's going to get away with it and does not care what happens.
Because he can occasionally seem like quite a sort of fun character in the sense that there's a certain larger-than-life sort of aspect to him, but McBain is definitely making sure that you know he's like out-and-out just evil as well. That there's no sort of, oh, well, you know.
He's definitely really good fun for the series. Because I remember from this point on, you were kind of... You know, you'd obviously get a couple that didn't have him after a death, but then you'd be like, oh, when you opened one and you realised he was back, you was like, oh, what's he going to be up to this time?
Yeah.
Normally some other grandiose scheme.
Yeah. A lot of his plots have a certain amount of whimsy to them, but he's also capable of, like, utter, just depraved act of evil.
Would you say? Six or something?
Six or
something,
I think,
like that?
Something like that. And it covers more or less all of the run of it, right?
Yeah, so probably one in every five or six from this point on, something like that.
Might be something like that. That sounds about right.
Hmm.
But for every super villain that you have with a super scheme and the chaos and distraction and getting out all the firemen, there's a nice chapter or part of a chapter in this where you see the structure of how the fire department works. It's almost like, oh, you could have written those as well. You could have done a fire department series, Ed. That would have been amazing. It would have been the London's burning to the bill of the 87th Precinct.
Crikey.
But for all of that, the solution at the end, the way that the scheme is foiled ultimately not the bombs, they happen, but they're getting away with the money, is pure chance and coincidence.
Yeah, as it often is with these. And it, when you read in the end and how it all goes... tits up, for a better expression.
Well, that's probably what Ed would have written. Yeah,
it was just a Bobby on the beat, wasn't it? A totally chance encounter. And
yeah, it's a slightly dopey patrolman who just really fancies an ice cream.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of as it sometimes is with these criminals in real life as well. The false plates on the car,
there's enough to sort of arouse his suspicions, and then he actually becomes a bit less dopey and kind of realizes that something is afoot.
An ice cream van with the wrong plates with two men in it. Ooh, yeah,
try to get on a ferry for some reason.
Yeah, just
all they'd have had to do is actually buy some ice creams.
Yeah,
they could have bought a box of ice creams. It wouldn't have mattered what people asked for then. You could have just gone, oh, we're out of them. All we've got is Cornettos.
Yeah.
That's some Cornettos.
Or they could have just had a vehicle that nobody would have ever
just
wanted.
Just some plain, unmarked van where they wouldn't have had to buy all the uniforms. You get the impression that the deaf man quite enjoys the pageantry of ordering the costumes and get everyone dressed up and the elaborate sort of...
Well, he goes to a shop, a costume shop run by a man called Douglas McDouglas. That's right.
And he even tells him what he's going to do. He pretends he's directing a movie. Oh, what's it called? The Great Bank Robbery.
Yeah. It's this big fat man who wanted to be an actor but ended up running a costume shop. A really tatty costume shop. I think it's called Douglas McDouglas. I love this when Ed McBain has to make up character names, because one of the ways they find out who the corpse is at the start of the book is they interview a guy in a bar whose name is Christopher Random.
Yeah.
That is literally like he thought, what can I call this character? Oh, I can't think of an actual name. Random?
He's a brilliant pisshead character, isn't he? Calls him Sir all the time. You know, they don't know whether to believe him because he's kind of clearly permanently drunk, this guy.
But he just sort of says, Christopher Random, Scourge of the Orient.
as we always sort of, we always manage to find these amazing sort of little one-shot characters who crop up in these things. And he's one of the best, isn't he?
I don't think he's going to last much longer, this guy, really, given how much he drinks in the short period where Carrella and Hernandez are interviewing him.
Yeah, he has like four drinks in about 2 minutes.
With his catchphrase of, drink hearty, lads, this stuff here puts hair on your clavicle, it does. Ah!
He's good value, isn't he?
He is, but
he sets him on the right trail, though, doesn't he?
He certainly does.
He's very much a functioning alcoholic because he's compos mentis enough to actually recognise the photo in the paper and ring up the police, but they find him in a bar and you get that excellent scene.
Christopher Random. Yeah, no, a good character.
Okay, well, we really need to get towards summing up this one, really. I'm sure we've got more to talk about in the bonus episode, which we will do afterwards, especially the book covers, as Steve-O has hinted at the majesty of the one that he's got. But I think for the first time in 2018, I need to fire up Kenneth, really. I did do a short solo episode earlier in the month to just keep things ticking over, where I did dig out some archive material about where Kenneth came from. And so you all know a little bit more about him now, but we're going to fire him up and I'm going to work out what
is that
our...
a true story?
It is. You haven't heard it, have you?
No.
I'll play it later. So, you know, I can't keep that from you. You need to know the important Kenneth information that's been discovered in the dusty archives.
Dusty archives? That'd be another good character name. Could be a librarian.
Yeah, dusty archive.
Got some...
That'd have been a good name in about 1964.
He's got some
dusty archive.
He's got some important artifacts that are critical to the solving of a crime.
I wonder if anyone's got the surname Archives. I wonder if anyone's got the surname Random, to be honest. That seems more likely.
Yeah. Isn't there somebody Random? I don't know.
I've never met anyone with a surname Random.
No. I wonder if Random House Publishers is named
I was thinking that as well,
Random.
About Ken Random and Sandra House. Or it's Ken and Sandra again, like Ken and Sandra Internet. One of our episode titles from way back when. So, ratings-wise,
We need to get up the... we need to do the ratings without knowing...
We need to check
comparables.
Kenneth's output. So I'm just going to look that up now. Okay, so I've got Kenneth's scores up here. I'm not going to go through all of them this time. Safe to say the last three books, Till Death, got a very low score of 69, Police Shield. King's Ransom was our high point so far with 89. And Give the Boys a Great Big Hand was 83, Police Shields. If you want to look at the scores, Kenneth's output is available in digital format at the blog. And you can visit it there, and it will be updated after this as well. So I think I'm going to go over to Steve-O to see what his summing up of
oof.
The heckler is.
Oof.
You made a yeah. woof noise.
Yeah, well, exciting. Yeah, no, yeah, just, you know, it's a big deal going first in a summing up. But
it is.
No, an excellent book, and very good to read back because you remember the Deaf Man novels slightly differently than the other ones somehow, I don't know.
Well, there's not much recurs other than the police characters in these series.
Yeah, so when you get something else recurring, it's quite nice. And I like the also the length of time spent following the
villain.
Criminal element as much as the law enforcement agencies.
I will just say one thing, just interrupt, sorry. I've remembered, in terms of throwbacks to earlier books and things that recur, in this book we get a throwback to the very first book because there's stuff about Miscolo, the clerical officer, is trying to raise money for the widow of one of the cops shot in the first book.
That's true, actually.
The very first book. Plus, we also, from that same story, and he has appeared since, he was in King's Ransom, we get news twat Cliff Savage turning up.
Oh, yes.
As well, making a big hoo-ha about not being allowed to get the story for his newspaper.
Getting very short shrift from Mr. Corella.
Yeah. So, sometimes these characters crop up, but I think, yeah, villain-wise, no one other than the Deaf Man.
Exactly. So I'm going to go, I think it's a 9 out of 10, 90 Police Shields.
Ooh, good Lord.
Christ.
I will go.
I'll go next then, just to mix things up and give Morgan some thinking time, and thus denying myself thinking time.
Oops.
I don't know whether I'd go as high as 90. Oh, gosh, it's a tricky one. I'm so annoyed at the moment with the awareness of the writing of the female characters. That's really rankled a little bit, but
I think they're always a bit bad in all of them, though, aren't they?
The earlier ones,
yeah,
I think.
I know, it's a tricky one. I just think in this one it's very, very clumsy. Clearly it was, on Ed's mind while he was writing this at the time. He was really, really thinking about boobs. So, if we factor that in, and we factor in that it is a strange sort of, it's almost a two-part novel between the initial setup and then the big event of the bombs and the stuff at the end, which is amazing. Almost more modern than modern, really, as I say about the terrorism and stuff. I think I'll go for a solid 85 Police Shields. That's where I'm going. That's what I'm doing.
Marvellous.
So, Morgan.
Okay, yeah, well, as you say, I totally agree about the writing of the women in this, which is always going to knock a few Police Shields off.
Yeah. You can't expect to retain your Police Shields with that kind of attitude.
I know that was fairly typical of the crime fiction of the era, but that doesn't really excuse it. It's still, it's not the best, is it?
It wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't just quite so clumsy
Yeah. That's it. But on the other hand, an introduction of a great character who, we're going to have a lot of fun with, some big kind of cinematic plotting. And a lot to enjoy. I don't want to mark it too high because I feel like future Deaf Man novels are going to outstrip it.
Yeah, we have a tendency to mark everything quite
that's
high,
it.
Don't we?
I'm still going to mark it pretty high because it's a fifth. A bit of a kind
of... just on the height, I've not ruled out as having to go above 100.
I know.
We might have to recalibrate.
Yeah, we need to get into Kenneth's cogs and shift some of the bits around.
So I feel like it's an important point in the series. It's maybe not my favourite of the ones that we've read so far, although it's very good. I'm going to go for a solid 82 Police Shields.
82. Okay. Mm. What does Kenneth's ticker tape tell us about this? Well, it tells us, and do we round up or round down? Well, we round down when we use Kenneth. That's just the way the mechanism used to work. We couldn't round up before.
Rounding down. I've never heard anything as stupid in my life.
Look, these are police shields. They're not numbers.
Wow.
You know,
in pre-decimal days, we always
round down. I work in a job where we round down, actually, and I think it's absolutely absurd.
Blimey. Yeah. Well, there you go, then.
Well, that is the government, so anyhow.
You couldn't wear 0.3 of a police shield on your... Mind you, couldn't wear 85 of them.
No, so, yeah.
But it's...
You'll be very good at solving crimes. You'll be able to get through the door.
You might not get shot as much, though.
That's true. You have to yell all your questions from a flipping giant horse you have to ride around on.
Giant horse because of the weight of police shields you get hoisted onto. Yeah. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
It's going well.
Yeah, riding around on your horse, it's got 87 police horse brasses attached to the side of it. Make a bit of clanking noise, wouldn't you?
Going
around the streets of Isla.
But 85 is the score, which I think is a very respectable score.
It is. It's close to the top, isn't it?
But not very close. It's up there with the best of them.
You see, I think some of the future ones that in my mind will score very highly have, because this, it does this but delivers a bit more some of the later ones, I would say.
You can tell that...
And don't have as much creepiness to them.
You can tell McBain relishes using the deaf man as a way of having a new opportunity to tell stories in a different way and to really do something beyond the procedural thing. In this, it gives him a chance to sort of really get quite baroque.
Yeah,
complex.
Expands the scope, doesn't it? It's tremendous.
Another good. I always quite like the ones where they don't actually solve it themselves as well. Like a cop on the beat.
Mm. Yeah, none of the actual detectives are getting commendations in this book, are they? No. Really? But that patrolman, you would assume, would.
Mm.
So, good on him.
Good on him for just really fancying an ice cream.
The end of April, so it must have been quite warm. So we'll finish up there. The next book we will be reading and talking about is See Them Die, which is a gang warfare-based one, as far as I can recollect, but I haven't read it for a long time. In the interim, we should be doing our episode about High and Low, the Akira Kurosawa film based on King's Ransom. But until that time, we will say goodbye using our voices like this. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.